And I thought to talk to other communists is silly. They know as much as I do. And some of them know more. So I said to Judge Bacon, Judge Bacon, and this was during the recess, you know, I was just not long ago read by a famous judge in New York who said, we must not forget as judges what we know to be so as men. Now, you're a man before you're a judge. What do you think when people are desperate, they have no jobs? What do they think they're going to do? Says, God only knows. Well, I said, that's what Taft said. And God has nothing, you know, but God may know. But you ought to know as a judge. How can you blame them, he said. And I said, I wonder if you've ever read All Quiet on the Western Front. He said, yes, I have. I said, what do you think of it? He said, just the same as you. I said, you don't know what I think of it, but I want to know what you think. He said, the fallacy of war, the absolute fallacy of it. I said, yes, but we have war, don't we? Kill people and then afterward we jail them. You know what Eugene Debs said, Judge Bacon? He said, the heroes of today are the hobos of tomorrow. And that's very true. I said, you ought to know something of what's going on in the world. Just being a judge isn't enough. You ought to know. You ought to know what's happening in Russia and why it happened. He said, well, I said, did you ever hear of James Russell Lowell's poem, Freedom? He said, no. Do you know it? I said, yes. He said, well, recite it. I said, all right, you know that.
Yes, you recited it.
Yeah. And he says, oh, that's a beautiful poem. He says, listen, will you do something for me? I said, well, what can I do for Judge Bacon? He says, you could copy that poem for me. I'd like to have it. I said, all right, I'll do that. I said, but you read some books and don't understand what's going on. How can you stay there and judge when you don't know what's going on? He said, well, what book should I read? So I told him, and I've forgotten his name. This is that Russian Jewish guy who came here when he was about 11 years old, and he wrote 3 books about the Soviet Union. Broken Earth, which the revolutions was literally breaking earth. Then the red fog lifts, and Red Dead, you know. They're well written, he was a guy. I said, now this is an American writer who went there, and he knows the language, so read it and see that it is part of the world, you know. You have to know that this is all right. You know what happened? About a month afterward, we came down at that same court, and one of the clerks came over and said, you know, Mrs. Herman, Judge Bacon mislaid that girl as you wrote down what book she... He said, and I want to read those books, too. Will you make us another copy? I said, I'll be glad to. And I wrote that. I said, I'll give you a copy. I'll write down some more books. He says, I'll be glad to, because I want to know what's happening, what you folks are doing and why.
Well, what happened at the trial itself?
At the trial then, and the judge, he said, I'm ashamed to tell you what he said. He seemed so silly. He said, now, Mrs. Herman is different altogether. This highly cultured and compassionate woman, I free her entirely because she engages in no violence and everything. She just has a great compassion for it. And when the constable or whoever it was came and said, took my hand and said, now you're free. I said, no, I'm not free. I was arrested for the same thing as the others. And I'm not going free unless they go free. He says, you have nothing to say about it. The judge says you're free. I says, but I'm not going. I don't think that's right. So one on each one picked me up and took me outside and said, look, the judge says you're free and you're not going back in jail. You don't have anything to say about it. You're through here. And that's all. And I know some of the comrades thought that all I had done to talk to the judge was to... I told it to him, you see, and that was the reason.
And what happened to the others then?
They were sent back to jail.
For how long?
For none of them for more than 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
But one of them was the head of the textile workers' union, Sonia Balkin, who was really, and she was schooled in it and everything. But you know, I never agreed with that you shouldn't talk to the enemy. I said, well, who should I talk to them? And I did. I talked to the And then they can really, you see. But tell me, what is wrong about speaking to him?
I don't see anything wrong with it.
Well, so, and I remember the judge here in 1940-something, but he was a nice guy. Judge Ambrose, he was a very nice guy. When Dick Webster, Francis Ruth's husband, they were arrested and accused of murder, and they had nothing to do with the law of trauma and everything. And Judge Bacon, you know, he liked Francis very much. He was very good. And Judge Ambrose and I, he married Carol Jean and Sammy, and said, but when they wanted to pay him, he said, I'd just put it away for the first baby. He wouldn't take anything. But when I told, he was a lovely guy. He said to me, you know, Barbara, I want to tell you something. You had the wrong lawyer. You had Gallagher. Gallagher's a nice guy. He knows the law, but he loses his temper. When you lose your temper, you know, so there's a guy who's of Arabian descent. He lived in Long Beach. Really a close friend of mine. Afterward, I got to dislike him, but he had been arrested, and I said, and I had given money for his defense, and he was a clever son of a bitch, but he was a good lawyer. So Judge Ambrose said, this is who you should have had, Shibley, Frank Shibley. This is the way he tried the case. He said, you know, two law firmmen brought before me. Now he says, I tell you, Mrs. Nestor, I'll swear they were guilty as hell. But Shibley said, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, look at my poor client. See, nature was very, very negligent in them. Look at the kind of faces they gave them. Two strikes against them right from the beginning. They were as innocent as the newborn babes. But because their faces are against them, are you going to consign them to more hell, going to find them guilty? They do. They wouldn't hurt a fly. You know that the jury freed those guys, and Judge Ambrose said, you know, I'll swear to you, those guys were guilty as hell. But he said, that's what you should have gotten. I said, but Shibley is a very tricky lawyer. He said, well, you know, when you go to trial, you go to see your defendants, not go ahead and be worried about whether the judge is the nicest kind of a guy in the socially in the world. And I knew Shibley very much. We went to hear when there was a case of the young people like that protesting against the war. And the judge who was trying it was a religious guy. And Shibley said to him, you know, a judge, and I've forgotten, this was in Long Beach. I went with LaRue McCormick. And Shibley said to him, you know, judge, while we have men of reputation like you are, a man of God, you don't have to fear, because you, I know, are against war, too. For did Isaiah not say that the sword shall be beaten into plowshares, and man will know war no more? This is the thing you practice. Therefore, I know that I rest my case in the hands of a merciful man who is a man of God, and he freed those guys.
Well, Barbara, getting back to your arrest up in Oakland, were you and Bert in jail in San Francisco then, or in Oakland?
In Oakland.
In Oakland. And did the Anita Whitney put up the money herself? The ILD branch didn't have the money.
No, I think Anita Whitney put up her own money for my defense.
Were you all in?
She all did. No.
No, I mean on bail, before the trial.
Well,
or you weren't on bail, you weren't on
no,
the
trial? No,
the trial,
yes, we were all released on bail. Mm-hmm. That's right. And the trial was very shortly afterwards.
I see.
But I remember that I had the awful feeling about jail. Dorothy said, look, you get used to it, it's not so terrible. The fact that you couldn't go anywhere, that you were there, to me, it was a horrible thing. I had a horrible headache, and I couldn't eat a thing. I couldn't sleep.
Mm. Well, how come you were here? It took them that long to get the money together for the bail, is that it? How come you were there?
Well, Anita Whitney had been a rich woman, you know, but she gave most of her money.
But it took that long?
Now, I'll tell you, she was arrested on a case with a young Negro boy, 16 years old. The judge freed her and wouldn't free the boy. Mm. She said, "Judge, here I stand. We were both arrested for the same thing, and we either both go free or I stay here with him." And he says, "Free the boy."
But they didn't do that for you when you
no,
said it.
No.
Do you remember who defended you at that trial?
No, I really don't. But at that time, you know who was the district's attorney at that time? Warren. And afterward, he became a very liberal guy. But at that time, he was anything but.
At the trial itself, you were charged with disturbing the peace then?
Yeah.
Disturbing
the peace and congregating in a forbidden zone.
Mm-hmm. I see. Now, Barbara, this seems to be a local action by your own ILDW group then, is that right?
Yes, although it wasn't only the ILD group there. They had the party and the people who were supporting the unions. It was really a conglomerate group.
I see. So those who were arrested with you weren't necessarily all from your...
No. Great many of them were... Sonia Baldwin was a union guy.
Mm-hmm. Well, the way the ILD worked, there were certain national campaigns. But then would your own group get involved in local issues, or would you only...
No, we were involved in local... For instance... The defense of the Scottsboro Boys was not a local thing, and the defense of that other black guy, that I've forgotten his name now, but he was quite famous at that time, or Benjamin Davis, mm-hmm. Those were not local things. Those were national things, and the ILD is the one that supported them.
Well, most of your work was on these national issues.
Then. That's right.
Now, on the local issues, would that be the ILD group? Or
yes, the ILD had, you see, they had divisions of that. They would have then the group that would defend those that were on local and everything and get them lawyers and things. And then the national thing that we said they supported nationally.
Like when you would collect dues for your chapter, say, would all of it go to the national office, or would you...
No, a part of it went to the national office, and a part of it would be kept in the local things.
For the district office?
Yes.
And then...
The office of Hill was down at that, where that Mesa Theater is on 2nd and Broadway. That's where the ILD office was.
Where was the district office up north?
In San Francisco.
Well, so you were...
But there was an office in Oakland also.
So the local dues would then be used for what? I mean, the dues that were kept?
Yes, for the office, for leaflets, for anything that they needed. No one got paid.
There was no paid organizer or paid...
There may have been for nationally a paid organizer, otherwise most of them served without anything. That's one of the things that I objected to also, because I thought that no one can afford to work for nothing, because they have to pay rent, they have to buy food, and I thought that this is terrible. You haven't any idea how in my house in Berkeley, how many people slept on the floor, you know, with blankets and everything, how many blankets we lost because they needed it, they took it with them. You didn't question mine, thine, you know, and everything. And I thought that everyone ought to get paid.
How did most people respond to that idea?
Well, many of them for a long time accepted it. You know, it took an awful long time before I ever heard anyone object to it, you know. And I remember when Anita Whitney, I told you about it, that the guy who was the head of the ILD there, who helped in it, took her car and $600 and ran away with it. And I said, what are you going to do about it, Anita? His name was John Small. She said, I'm not going to do anything about it. How, if he wasn't getting paid, how can he live? I can afford to lose the car and the $600. The $600 was what he had collected for the ILD, but he took it. But she said, how can I thank him? Look, he's been working for months. How in the hell could he pay it? And everything. And I said, well, Anita, only you could do that. And then my daughter Frances had given $500 for the ILD for to bail out some prisoners. And when the thing was over, Anita Whitney said, when my husband died, she came and she said, how are you fixed for money, do you think? I said, we will get about $9,000 insurance, Anita. So do you need money at all now? And I said, no, we don't need anything at all. But she was always ready to. So when she went to Frances, and she said, Frances, do you need your money? She said, and Frances, at that time, Frances was 17 years old, and she was working in the public library and getting $95 a month. And at that time, that was very good pay. She had only graduated from high school. She hadn't gone to the college. And she said to Anita, Anita, this is for the cause. You've given a whole lot more than that. Keep my $500 and let it, never mind about it.
But Barbara, how did you think, you thought that like people should get paid out of the dues collected, is that it?
I think that they ought to have had established a fund, you know, whether it was locally or nationally, that people got paid for certain things, no matter if it was the minimum rate, but at least they got paid something. Mm-hmm. Some didn't even get their car fare.
You know, that's a very important issue that's being raised in the women's movement today against volunteers, and that people get paid for organizing and for...
Well, I think, you see, if there are people so wealthy that they have so much that they just want to do that, well, that's all right. That's, you know, but otherwise, you know, working people, I don't think it's as effective. When someone is in charge and is getting paid, they're responsible. But when you're volunteering, you don't have the same sense of responsibility because you're donating it. So it's too bad, but really and truly, there's a whole lot of truth in it. Mm-hmm. See, those of us who came to help us, but we weren't there in the office doing all the whole day. That's different. But the people who work there organizing and are in there, they ought to get paid.
Did you ever publicly raise this issue?
Yes, I did. Mm-hmm. I did. They all agreed with me, but they said, look, it's so hard to get the money. I said, well, if we get the money for when we need it for something, then we ought to get it for this. I always raise that, you know. I said, you know, I don't think it's fair to anyone. Why should they give more of their time than anyone else?
Barbara, did you see the ILD as being only a defense group, or did you also see it as a way to educate and organize?
Yes, I did, always. I think although their function was defense, nevertheless they also served an educational purpose in organizing people and teaching them what was going on. Yes, I did. I've always felt that it was a very important organization. I felt very, very sad when it stopped functioning. When the last defender came out, I felt very sad.
Did you remain active primarily in the ILD up until it folded?
Yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And then it was after that that you went back into party work?
Yeah, I went into the party then actively in 1936.
Mm-hmm. And the ILD folded when? in the mid to earlier.
Yes, of course. Yes, it did.
What?
That was too bad. I thought that was one of the most worthwhile organizations. You know, the Civil Liberties Union at that time was not a very good thing, you know. They didn't defend Elizabeth Gurley Finn, and she was one of the founders. And she was one of the founders.
They kicked her out, didn't
they? Yes. And she was one of the founders. Yes.
Barbara, can you tell me more about your life? It sounds like your house in Berkeley was very much a center of activities. Was that because of the children's involvement or your own involvement or what?
I didn't get just
it. It sounded like your house in Berkeley was very much a center of activities.
It was. You know, our house in Berkeley became so that when the post office or the police couldn't find any literature, socialistic literature come, and they couldn't find anyone to get their daughter to us, because they couldn't find someone.
Was that because of the children's involvement, or your did you have a reputation as being that?
Well, I was pretty well known, too, that I was very active in anything that went on.
Mm-hmm.
And our home was a kind of a headquarters. My son brought some students from the university to our house. And then I told you that at the library where Francis worked, I had some of the librarians over for dinner, and we discussed things, and I asked her, look, Adelaide, Birkenfield, I think her name was, she was really a lovely woman. I said, I know that we can't leave the new masses there, but couldn't we leave a few? Look how very important articles they have there. She said, I'll tell you what now. Now remember, I don't exist as far as you're concerned, but there's a little alcove there, you see. It's a fount there. Leave a few copies around there and everything, and I'll see that it gets some circulation. But I know when the Spanish-American, when the Spain was invaded, Kerrigan was in school. Do you know that those teachers didn't know what it was? Because, you know, there for the first time, the loyalists were the good guys, and the rebels were the bad ones. That was the first time. And Carol Jean would bring literature to them, and they'd say, what's happened now, Carol Jean? What are they doing and why? They really didn't know it and everything. And then Carol Jean said, Mama, why don't you come and talk to them? And I brought them literature and sent them literature, and they were always there to get it.
Well, Barbara, while you were still up in Berkeley and Oakland, did you belong to participate in any other things besides the ILB?
I belonged to the parent-teachers, and I spoke up in the parent-teachers. You know, they didn't generally allow you to speak, and they tried to stop me. And I said, as a member of the parent-teachers, I am a parent, and I want to work with teachers. I have a right to bring up these subjects because they are in the interest of our children. And if I am not allowed to speak, then what kind of democracy do you have in the parent-teachers?
What sort of things did you bring up?
Well, I bring up about the war, the gathering crowds of war, what they were doing, for the ammunition that they were supporting so much of that. Instead of that, they always have money for the military, but not for the needs of the people. And I said, look, others should be aware of these things. And whatever happens, if any of the remotest part of the world, it affects all of us. Because if you remember that it may not have been the cause of war, but that happened in a distant country in Yugoslavia. And pretty soon our own boys died there. So it's very important for us to know what's happening all over.
How did they respond to you?
Very well. The principal of the school, who is the head of the parent teachers, he became such a friend of mine, and he said to me, his name was Richter, that was at Horace Mann right here.
Oh, this was in Los Angeles.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, I have sons. I don't want them to go and die on the battlefield. But I can't speak up or I'll lose my job. But I'm very grateful for people like you who do speak up. And then I made friends with some of the women who came there, who were, there was one woman by Mrs. Erickson. They said that she was so tough and, you know, she wouldn't do this or that. She was nothing of the kind. She was one of the finest, nicest persons you ever met. And when I spoke to her, she said, I'll be very glad to help you, but remember that the parent teachers, you know, the national parent teachers is a very sectarian group, and it's very difficult. But we'll put our heads together, and we'll put across some things. And I never found any difficulty in getting people like that to work.
So you spoke to wherever you were, you spoke.
Yes, I did. Yes, I really did.
Now, what happened as the depression started to approach? Did Joe lose his job, or was he still working?
Joe? Well, Joe died in 1930.
No, but as the depression in 1929 approached.
Well, at that time, he was still working, mm-hmm. but things were getting pretty bleak, and he was very sick already.
Oh, he was already sick?
Yes, he was dying of not only diabetes, but his heart had been affected.
But he continued to work?
Yes. Mm-hmm. He died in Seattle just a few days after he left home.
Oh. And he died in
1930? Yes, September the 20th.
And then you decided after he died to move back down to Los Angeles?
Yes. That's when we sold our house then in Berkeley. We got almost nothing for it because at that time, you know, things were already. And we came down to Los Angeles because my mother and sisters and my brother, most of my family were in Los Angeles.
Oh, when had they moved out here?
They had always lived here.
Oh.
So we came down here. The thing was that I had to have an operation. You see, I told you I had 13 abortions
mm-hmm.
that I had myself. And Frances had come up there then, and she was about 20 at that time. And she insisted that I have the operation then, when Joe was only dead not quite a year. The uterus used to come right out.
Mm.
So we went to one of the doctors who had been very friendly about the Soviet Union, just because he was friendly with the Soviet Union, he thought he was a great doctor. Well, he was nothing of the kind. He recommended a surgeon who operated. You know what he did? An operation no longer had long, long before not. He took the. I was 40, almost 47 years old. What in the hell did I need the uterus for? He should have performed a hysterectomy. Instead of that, he put the uterus on top of the bladder. And that's over 40 years ago. I've had such a hard time when urinating. Because of this and everything, I have a hell of a time, and I sure wish the Dr. Edward, the surgeon, had quit before I ever saw him. But you see, Dr. Philip, and I've forgotten his last name, every one of the radicals loved him because he'd gone to Soviet Union and spoke glowingly of the Soviet Union. So he became a kind of a hero.
In Los Angeles?
No, I had it in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. I went to a Catholic hospital, the St. Mary's. You know what it cost me? The operation cost $125. That operation now cost over $1,000. And room, I was in there with three people, cost $4 a day, and I got excellent care, just wonderful care. They were just wonderful. Now it costs almost $100. You know, when I went in the hospital for this arthritis a few months ago, it cost for every day $87 a day. $87 one day. It's really absolutely outrageous. See, that's one thing, Tommy, that in the socialist countries, all medical care, all hospitals is free to everyone. Even in England, which isn't a socialist country, health care is free.
So, Barbara, after Joe died, then the whole family moved to Los Angeles?
About a year later.
Now, did Bernard move down with you too, or did he stay?
We did what?
Did Bernard move down with you, or did he stay up north?
No, Bernard was still alive. He was still going to UC.
Uh-huh. But Francis and Dorothy came down with you?
Francis was down here, and Dorothy, of course, came down. Dorothy was only 15 years old.
And then how were you
and
able
Cal Jean was only five.
Just a few years old. How were you able to support the family then after
Well,
that?
See, what Joe had done, and that's what you say, that when we bought the house in Berkeley on Josephine Street, he'd gotten out a kind of an insured thing, so that if anything happened to him, they would pay off the house, and whatever was more than that, I'd get. So they paid for the house, and I got $3,500 beside that. Then I had insurance that I had carried for years and years. When I first went into that, it was the Germania. And after the war, they called it the Guardian. And I got from that insurance company, altogether I had $9,000. And, you know, at that time, things, you know, in the third, you know, everything cost almost a fraction of what now. And that's what I... And then I went into the stock market. That's right. And I've lived on the stock market ever since.
Really?
Yes. You know...
Isn't that a funny way for
coming? One of the comrades who said to me, Barbara, how could you go in the stock market? I said, when you have a job and you're working for Radio Corporation of America, what do you think you're doing? You think you're supporting a socialist cause? You're supporting that too. Look, I have no skills. What could I do? I went to work in the Mission Towel and Supply Company. I fixed uniforms and towels and everything that were mended and everything. I got $2.50 a day. I worked eight hours on a power machine, and it cost me 40 cents car fare, so I had $2.20 altogether. So do you think I could support a family on that? And I have no skills. There's nothing I can do. And as far as being a sale, I'd be a good saleswoman. But, you know, you find them all over unemployed. They're laying people off, not hiring new ones. So what shall I do about it? I'm living under capitalism, and I have to use capitalist methods and everything. So the only thing is that somebody brought over a trustee guy who was a very nice guy, but he was supposed to be great one for the stock market. He knew about it. And he told me to sell all my stocks in here because it was going down. This was 1931. And he had made $20,000 for another client. So I sold my stocks. And I had the best Pacific Gas and Electric, General Electric, all the things that really... he sold it all. And he invested it in Auburn Auto, and he sold it short. I don't know if you know what that means. Yeah, selling short means that you're selling that it'll go down. Mm-hmm. Instead of that, J.P. Morgan took it over, and it went up 20 points instead of going down 20, and I lost every cent I had. All I had left was what it was. I had $1,400 coming from my house in Berkeley that I had sold, and that's all I had. You know, I almost lost my mind. Carol Jean was 6 years old. And what did I do? I almost went crazy. And a friend of mine who wanted to help me, she had known everyone, you know, in New York and everything. She brought Frank Lederman over. He was one of the heads of the ladies' garment workers in New York. And he meant well. He did well. He lost everything he had, too. But I lost everything, and I thought I'd go insane. I thought, what in the hell would I do? So what I did, I had, from the $1,400 I went to the stock market, and I took $740 and bought 50 shares of Douglas Aircraft at $14 a share. The next day it went to $12. Do you know how I felt? But in 1 year... but I had paid $740 for, I sold for $3,750, and that gave me my start.
Well, how did you make that decision? Did you make it yourself?
Yes, I made it myself. There was nothing I could do. What else could I do? I knew nothing of the stock market except the tax rolls that when they had invested. And I remember I met Bernard Baruch's nephew, was one of those that came to J.F. Hutton. And he said to me, you know, you're a widow. You have no business to buy Douglas aircraft. I said, what do you think I ought to buy? He said, buy a bond. I said, but I can't make anything on it. But you can lose that. I said, and I can't lose it on bonds. Not as likely, but you would absolutely guarantee that I couldn't? I said, what are you buying? He said, that's different. I asked my uncle what to buy. His uncle made $30 million in the stock market. I said, well, so, but I met another guy who was a fascist, an Italian fascist, who said to me, never buy anything that doesn't pay a dividend. Otherwise, you're only keeping your boarders who can't pay there for the board and room. Buy only thing and that are necessary for the economy of the country. Don't ever buy anything because you are in no position to go fly by night. That's all right for people who can afford it. You can't. Buy something that's necessary in our economy. So when I did, I did. That's what I did. So I bought and I sold. And I've managed to live on it all these years.
Do you have a broker?
I had. At that time, I went to J.F. Hutton because I went into Hutton because they there happened to be not...
Did you know that you were communist?
No. Well, even there I would talk about socialism. This Italian well, one of the guys who was in charge, he says, listen, Barbara and Esther, don't you bring in this kind of socialism. We're a capitalist organization, not a socialist. Don't you bring in that socialist thing. I said, well, don't you think you ought to know something about socialism? He said, what for? He said, Russia isn't going to invest in us. So what do I have to know about that? I'm living here, not there. He said, if you want to live like that, you go to Russia. But you know that fascist, he was such a smart guy, you can't imagine. But you know, I can't imagine why they felt sorry for me. Here I was, a poor little woman, you know, not knowing what to do. Here I was so desperate. They all gave me advice and really were awfully nice to me. This Italian fascist told me, look, she said, I want to tell you, buy at the Warner Brothers or... what's the other big firm?
MGM?
No. Pickford? No.
Oh, yeah, there was some Mary Pickford Studios.
So. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, he said, see, people love entertainment. They'll go to entertainment for the boy bread. So, and I made money on them.
That's it. So you've been living on the stock market since 1930 then?
I've been, not 1930, but 1930. In 1931. But if I had kept what originally the guy who was and Mr. Cavalier, who really was a very nice guy, he said, whenever I see people like you and come in with your insurance money, my heart bleeds for them because I'm afraid they'll soon lose everything because you don't know anything. But I can't understand the things he told me to get that Lieberman told me to sell. The Trotsky-eyed guy, sell everything. Those are the things I'd have been a rich woman. If I had kept all those, I'd be worth at least $75,000. As it is, but at least I managed. See, I still get the dividends on the thing I have now. I have also this. I have 50 shares of Ford Motor. You know, now as bad as it is, they raise the dividend. I get more dividend now on them than I got before. And yet, look, you know what's happening in that. And Burlington, you know...
The textile mill?
Yes. They double the dividend. I have 140 shares of that. And I have 250 shares of Martin Marietta, which... But they increased their dividend, but
What did most of your communist comrades think about this activity?
Well, most of them, I told you that a few of them said, how can you, and when I pointed out, listen, you go ahead and buy property and you rent it, what do you think that's it? Don't you think that's different? I said, how is it different? It's part of capitalism, isn't it? I'm living under capitalism. I'm fighting to establish socialism. I don't like capitalism. But while I'm living under there, what can I do about it? Starve while I'm waiting for socialism? I have no choice. It's true, isn't it?
I think it's interesting. I think that it's funny. It's just such an incredible contrast, I think.
I met a Trotskyite in the stock market. And he really knew the stock market well. He tried to be very friendly, but at that time, you know, we were afraid to be very friendly with Trotskyites and everything. His name, I think, was Elliot. That's all I can know about him. He said, what are you buying? I said, I'm not buying. I stay put. I can't afford to go ahead and buy and sell and buy and sell. I can't do those kind of things. So he made quite a bit of money in the stock market.
Well, but before you came down to Los Angeles, were you involved with the, they started having the unemployed council then up north, all over?
Well, Dorothy was very active in the unemployed council. Yes. I never was a member, but I supported them.
So you weren't active up north, though, in that?
No, well, Dorothy was. Mm-hmm. Dorothy was active both in Berkeley and Oakland and in Los Angeles. Dorothy was one of the heads of it. She really was very effective. She was very good. You know what she did? Once when she came in, there was a woman there with two children, one only a baby in arms and the other about 2 years old. And 2 hours later when she came back, that woman was still there and the children were crying and the woman looked ready to drop dead. She said, why are you still here? She said, well, they tell me I have to wait and the children are getting, I don't know what to do. I have nothing at home. So Dorothy went up to the desk and she said, why is this woman still here? Why aren't you taking care of her? If you don't take care of her at once, I'll bring the unemployed council down there. Oh, no, don't do that. Oh, no, don't, please don't do that, Miss Ray. She says, if she isn't taken care of right away, before the hour has passed, you'll have the unemployed council down here. And, you know, in 1/2 hour, they brought down a basket of food for her. They rented an apartment for her to stay. They came and took her and the two children and everything. And she said to Dorothy, oh, Dorothy, I can never thank you enough. Oh, Dorothy, I'll pray for you all the time. I'll never forget you. But Dorothy really was very effective in that work.
So you did not get involved yourself.